You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco, and welcome to Reality Sandwich. My name is Martin Matthews. I'm a certified medical hypnotherapist and healthful living advocate. And today on Reality Sandwich, where each week we serve up a palatable taste of the truth on topics of the mind, the body, the planet, our interhuman relations, and really things that we're dealing with and playing with and enjoying in our real life. Today I'm here with co-host Jason McLean of EmotionalAwareness.com. Jason?
Well, hello, Martin.
It's great to be back here with you. And today we have back one of my favorite guests, Mark Michael Lewis. Hi, Mark.
Hi. It's a pleasure to be back.
Great to have you back. Last time you were on, we were talking about your book, Relation Dancing. And the title of the show was The Problems Are the Solution. So at first I had to sit back and go, wait a minute, problems are the solution. And then we got into that. We had a phenomenal show all about that. And today we're back with you and talking about a new book of yours called The Key is in the Darkness, yet another perplexing title, which I'm just thrilled to get into, Unlocking the Door to a Spiritual Life.
Yes.
So before we jump into that a little bit, I'd like Jason to give us a full intro of Mark so all of our listeners can have a full idea of Mark and his background. And
thank you, Martin. Well, Mark Michael Lewis, who I'm lucky enough to call a friend, is the author of Relation Dancing and Problems Are the Solution, two guides to creating thriving and fulfilling partnerships. He's spoken before thousands of people and coached hundreds of individuals and couples on fulfilling relationships, communication skills, financial success, and personal development. Mark has a degree in psychology and combines insights from nearly 20 years of experience in the fields of philosophy, spirituality, and success. He currently lives and practices in the San Francisco Bay Area, where he is working on future books, seminars, and virtual internet learning experiences that empower the blossoming of humanity through the Life by Design Institute. Well, welcome, Mark. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here.
It is such a pleasure to be with the two of you.
So, first, tell us a little bit about this new book. It's written by both you and, I see here, Father Thomas Foley.
Yes, The Priest and the Punk.
The Priest and the Punk. Yes, he sent me a link earlier. It said, read about the book at thepriestandthepunk.com. I said, wait a minute, thepriestandthepunk.com.
That's right.
So that's a place to begin. How did the priest and the punk come together to write a book?
Exactly. After I wrote Relation Dancing and got out in the world, one of the people who read it was a gentleman by the name of Father Thomas Foley. And he had some very strong, very direct feedback for me about it, about really taking the ideas that were in it, which he thought were really great ideas, ideas that could make a big difference for people in their practical everyday life. But the form that they were in Relation Dancing was in such an intellectual form that he was clear that not everyone would be able to actually get to the ideas behind all of the thought that was required behind it. It was a very deep, challenging book. And so he started working with me on how I could take the same ideas and present them in a way that more people could get access to them. And in the process of working on that, we found that one of the passionate subjects that was the center of my life, the center of my coaching practice, and a lot of our conversations, surprise, surprise, he's a priest, was spirituality. And what is the nature of divinity? And how does God or spirit play a part in our everyday life? And so as we started working on it, we decided, well, why don't I write a book on spirituality directly? And we'd write it for the popular audience, something that my grandmother could read and enjoy and get value from. And so as we played with it, we came up with the title, The Key is in the Darkness, Unlocking the Door to a Spiritual Life. And I think the easiest way to start it off is there's a story from which the title comes. And you might recognize it. It's a popular story. It's been around for several generations, perhaps millennia. It's about a man who, he's walking along, it's a late autumn evening, and he sees another gentleman at night underneath a street lamp, looking through something in the leaves. And he's obviously, you know, kind of frantically looking for something. So he says, well, you know, do you mind if I ask, what are you looking for? And the guy says, oh, I've lost the key to my home, so I'm looking for it. And he says, oh, well, you know, two heads are better than one. Perhaps I can help you. So he gets down and starts rummaging through the leaves. After a couple of minutes, he goes, well, you know, perhaps we can be more efficient about this. Where exactly did you drop the key? And the guy says, oh, well, I actually lost it over there in the darkness, but the light's much better here. And this essential story is not only cute, I think it speaks to the heart of the human condition, which is that the real gifts that we have to get in our lives are typically uncomfortable for us to get. They're typically something that requires us to look at ourselves in a new way. Mm-hmm. And so they're kind of off in the darkness where there's monsters and the unknown. And so rather than looking there for the keys that are going to unlock our spiritual life, unlock our happiness, we end up looking where it's comfortable, in the street lamp. And even though we know we're not going to find the keys there, we look there anyway and pretend that we're searching. Right. And so it leads to a world in which we're trying to create success rather than meaning, where we're trying to look good rather than trying to be truly happy.
And is that what you mean by the keys in the darkness, or is that a slightly different aspect to the story?
It means, that's exactly what I mean. The key is in the darkness, that as long as we look in the places that we've always looked, mm-hmm. as long as we stay in the places in our life that we're comfortable, we're not going to find the things that make the biggest difference. We need to be able to risk going into the darkness, into our shadows, into our own discomfort, in order to find the key that's going to unlock our next level of happiness.
Or even unlock the very depths of our spirit, our divinity.
Yes. And
but I'm getting ahead of the story.
Well, let's back up a second. Let's talk a little bit about that. We end up striving for success and not fulfillment, you said, by sticking with what's in the light.
Yes.
And doing what we know, right?
Yeah.
And searching where the light is. And but then we maybe sometimes people get success
mm-hmm.
without fulfillment.
Absolutely.
So what is that about?
Well, so another way of thinking about it is imagine you're kind of on a leash, or you're a dog on a leash. What happens is there's a section that you can reach on the leash, which is inside your comfort zone. And within that section, you end up kind of overgrazing. You end up eating all of the food that's available in that sense. And you can build up a tremendous amount of success, a tremendous amount of worldly wealth, reputation, you can have a great relationship, you can build great health.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens is the place outside of the leash, your comfort zone in that darkness, are the places that you haven't gone yet. And so the greatest wealth of meaning and purpose lives in that space. Because in the story, the key is in the darkness. The man truly knows that the key is not where he's looking. But he looks there anyway, because he's afraid to face the fact that he doesn't want to face the darkness. He feels shame about the fact that he's not willing to face the darkness. And so to distract himself, he tries to build a comfortable life under the street lamp. He gets a great car, he gets a great house, a great relationship. Mm-hmm. But because he's building the house and the car and the relationship to avoid the darkness, it's not fulfilling to him.
Right. So he's, in a way, this is sounding, I've talked about this notion similarly in different kind of different ways, this idea around us doing these things that don't really get us what we want, but that may make us feel good kind of in the moment. So we're, in a way, reinforcing ourselves, making ourselves feel good, but never really getting to touch that inner button of personal fulfillment, because what the things that we're doing and we're striving for are, like you say, within that circle. Mm-hmm. They're doable mm-hmm. for us. We know we can achieve them. So in a way, it's kind of an instant win, whether or not we're aware it's an instant win or not.
Mm-hmm.
We may know at some level that we're not really, really pushing ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So we continue to repeat this cycle of doing stuff and, in a way, reinforcing ourselves for not really getting what we want.
Right. Well, as Jason was saying earlier, he says, so how does this fit into spirituality?
Mm.
Right? And the basic idea behind this book is that spirituality is the road to true happiness. that if you want true happiness, you need to go to spirituality, because there's a distinction between happiness. It does not come through comfort and through success. It comes through meaning. It comes through having a purpose to our lives, fulfilling the values that come from our heart and soul. And in the book, I discuss the difference between a key value and a street lamp value. There are certain values that we can pursue kind of in that comfort zone under the street lamp. And we pursue them in order to feel good about ourselves, because we feel that we question whether or not we're truly valuable. We question whether or not we're lovable, mm-hmm. whether or not we're a good person, whether or not we're a worthwhile human being. And instead of dealing with that question directly, what we try to do is prove that through our actions.
Right.
So we say, oh my gosh, I'm going to get a great career. And when I succeed at my career, then I'll truly be happy and successful. But then we go out and we get the career and we go, is this all there is? Right? Or we go, what I really need is a relationship. I don't have a relationship. And when I get this relationship, then I'll be truly happy. And so we go look for the relationship, and when we get it, we actually get what we want, but it doesn't prove that we're valuable.
Now, did we go after those things because we've learned somewhere previously that we then think that by having them, we'll have that success? If we go out and get one of those relationships that I've seen or observed previously in my life, and it looks like those other people are happy, if I go and have one of those, that I'll then be, that I'll have that? So therefore, it's not really of my creation in some way?
Yeah, in a sense, our culture teaches us that the way to happiness is through wealth, mm-hmm. fame, sex, and reputation or success, going out and really creating your mark in the world. And so most of us go along, we read the magazines, we look at television, and it tells us, go out and be attractive and get the partner and get these things. And so we do that thinking that it's going to make us happy.
It has been said that the ultimate spiritual practice is disidentifying with that which you think is you or an mm-hmm. object in your awareness, which mm-hmm. brings in the Eastern aspect to this. Mm-hmm. Could you speak to that?
Okay. Well, so to weave these two ideas together, the idea of enlightenment or transcending yourself to become one with God, and on the other hand, looking for success in the world – the question becomes, what will truly make you happy in life? And in order to answer that, you have to answer the question, who am I? What is my nature? Because in order to find out what's going to make me happy, I have to know who and what I am. Mm-hmm. Because then I can do the things that will actually make me happy. But if I don't know who I am, then I can't really do the things that make me happy. And in our culture, what we teach people is who they are is their job.
Right.
Who they are is their body. Who they are is the amount of money they have, their social position. And so what happens is, let's say that I'm growing up and I think, oh, I'm a man. And as a man, I have to produce, I have to have a career and a reputation in order to be masculine, in order to be a real man. I have to be a provider. And so because I think that that's who I am, because I think that that's my nature, I then go out and do everything I can in order to be successful. Thinking that if only I'm successful, then I'll be a real man and I'll be good enough, I'll be lovable, I'll be a good human being. However, the Eastern traditions ask the question, well, who are you really? You know, and it's not just the Eastern traditions. We go back to Socrates, know thyself.
Right.
At the heart of the philosophical and the religious tradition, there's this question of really knowing who you are and how you relate to God or divinity or the essence that created and sustains the universe, whether you understand that to be a mystical power or an evolutionary force. Who are we and how do we relate to that? Well, the categories were given by culture in terms of, you know, sex and money and wealth and fame. They aren't who we truly are. And so we think that they're going to make us happy, kind of like we think that if we stay under the street lamp, we can build up this great life. We can pretend like we're going to be successful. But until we know who we truly are, all of those things that we chase after end up leading us down the wrong path. And the darkness, the key that's in the darkness, represents who we truly are. But in order to find out who we truly are, we have to face our own fears. We have to face our own shame. We have to answer the question, really, am I good enough? How would I ever prove that I'm worthwhile as a human being? And that's the spiritual question. And,
Deeply.
Yes. And in the book, it leads us through a series of ideas and exercises that get us in touch with who we truly are, such that we're willing to face the darkness. And to ask the question who we really are, we have to understand how we relate to this thing called life or the universe. And people call that by different names. In the book, I talk about divinity. Again, it could be God, it could be evolutionary imperatives. What is this thing that sustains the universe, and how do I relate to it? And facing that question can be a dark and scary task. But when you can face that and go into the darkness of not knowing and really look past who you think you are, then you can discover the key that unlocks a door to a deeper happiness.
Well, it's understandably a difficult question to ask oneself. I mean, we don't typically, right, in this society of ours, grow up in an environment where we're introspective, where we're asking ourselves these questions, where we're pondering our own emotional existence in the world. We unfortunately tend to become, and this may be in the last, you know, several hundred years of our existence, right, become these beings of replication of that which we learn and what we're told, as you were saying earlier, that we learn so much more as we're growing up what not to do than to do and how not to be, and then we become so striving for understanding of, you know, who we are and what we are. You know, I'm a student, I'm a bricklayer, I'm a lawyer, I'm a plumber, I'm a whatever. And we strive to fulfill those things and become the best that we believe those things can be defined as, or the potential of those things. And we strive, and all these things are all things that are not of our own personal inherent creation, which is what I'm hearing. What I'm hearing you're talking about is getting past, like, okay, what is all this stuff that we've, these pictures of identity that have been slapped upon us, or that we may have even self-imposed, and getting onto this journey of what's really beneath that? Who are we really, and what is our relationship to ourselves and to the world and to all these things?
And if we don't live up to those templates that get stuck on us by whatever society or our parents or our educational institutions, then this idea of shame comes into play.
Right.
And I'm really curious about that, because I want to get back to the shame guilt question. Because for me, freedom from shame and guilt is really kind of the beginning of emotional freedom. Mm-hmm. Not that we shouldn't be aware of our impact on other people, but we should really be free from most of the self-imposed guilt and shame. And you've said that guilt has given shame a bad name. What do you mean by that?
Yes. In the book, I talk about three interrelated questions and or ideas, which are shame, guilt, and forgiveness. And shame is different than guilt. But in our culture, we tend to confuse the two. And so to be clear about it, shame is the feeling that who we are, our very being, is somehow unlovable or unworthy, and therefore we do not deserve belonging, love, and caring. So shame is about the nature of our very being and whether or not we have the right to exist, whether or not we're worthy human beings. Guilt, on the other hand, is about whether or not we're acting in alignment with our own values. So guilt is about our actions, whereas shame is about our very being.
And I've never heard of it described quite that way.
Yeah.
Whenever I think of guilt, I think of it as being this proactive thing that one throws upon another, right? My grandma is guilting me for not calling her, you know, before noon on her birthday or something like this.
Yes, exactly.
Right? And if I play into that, then I feel guilty that I, there's something I should have done. But I guess it does play into this, right? There's something I believe I should have done.
Right.
Like, that I didn't do.
Exactly.
And I'm feeling guilty, whether or not I'm the one making up the rules about what I should or should not have done.
Yes. Well, so here's the thing. Sometimes people will come up to you and say, well, you should have done this. And you look at them and you say, no, I shouldn't have. You know, that's not my thing. You know, you should have called me by X time. Well, I didn't think I should have called you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't feel guilty when someone accuses me of something I don't think is wrong. Right? I have concern for the relationship. But if someone says, you know, you should have called me by noon on my birthday. Right? And I say, well, no, that's not my own rule. I don't feel guilt. But if they say, you know, you should have called me by noon, and I go, oh my gosh, yes, I really should have. Then I feel guilt because I've broken one of my own rules.
Now, your rule, there we go. Now, do we typically impose our own rules upon what we feel guilty or not feel guilty about?
That is where guilt comes from.
Actually, how often do we take on other people's rules?
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's another question.
Right.
That's another question. We can take on another person's rules, but it's not until we feel that we violated a rule that we feel guilt. Okay? And that's the important thing. Guilt is about our actions. It says there's a standard, and we failed to meet the standard, whether it's our own, in which case we definitely feel guilt, or sometimes somebody else will give us a standard and we'll take it on.
Right.
In fact, we could say that just as we think that we should be successful and we think that we, you know, should have wealth and a good relationship and be a good member of society, right? These are things that we think we should do. Well, we take on the guilt. We take on the standards of other people, of society. And the key to understanding shame versus guilt is that guilt, you can either set a standard and meet it, in which case you'll feel self-esteem, you'll feel good about yourself, mm-hmm. or there's a standard and you miss it, in which case you feel bad about yourself. You feel that you've missed that standard, and that's guilt. Now, when it comes to shame, it doesn't say, there's an action that I took that I either made it or didn't make it. It says, because I didn't complete the action, because I didn't hit that standard, who I am as a person is a bad person.
Mm.
Because it could be quite, you know, I could think that I am a phenomenal, great person. And in this case, I didn't match up to my values. So I can have that guilt without shame. And what I like to say is that it's the shame that causes all of the emotional problems in our life. Because it's when we doubt our own value, when we say, oh my gosh, I'm not good enough, that feeling of shame is so intense, it's so scary, it's so huge that we can't stand it. And so in order, like when we start to feel shame, we'll do almost anything to stop feeling it. And mm-hmm. so we distract ourselves in 100 different ways.
You talk about this in the book, about this distinction between guilt and shame?
I go through it in detail. And the third part of that equation is what we call forgiveness. And when you understand that shame is about your person and guilt is about your actions, forgiveness is about letting go of any shame that you have around an action while taking responsibility for any guilt that you have. For example, let's say that I think I should have called my father on his birthday. That's my own rule. Okay? And now it's the day after my father's birthday, and I didn't call him, which happened yesterday and today.
Mm.
I did, you know, take him to lunch the day before his birthday, but I was going to call him on his birthday, and I didn't.
Okay.
Right? Okay. So I broke my own rules, and I felt a sense of guilt around it. Okay. Now, at the same time, because our culture is so shame-based, I also felt shame about it. Like, oh my gosh, I'm a failure as a human being because I didn't call my father. Okay, so on the one hand, I had the guilt. I broke my own rule. I really wanted to call him on his birthday. And then I had the shame. Oh my gosh, who I am as a being is not worthy. I've failed as a human being. Well, when I recognized that, I forgave myself for forgetting my father's birthday. And what I mean by that is I let go of the shame. I said, wait a minute, this doesn't say anything about my being,
mm-hmm.
right? My being is good. I'm a spark of the divine. You know, I was one of the 10 million sperm that made it to the egg, right? And I'm a manifestation of the creativity of the universe. My very being is good. However, the fact that I did not call my father on his birthday means that I didn't build the relationship with him that I want. And so I'm now going to add more energy into my relationship with my father to kind of make up for the fact that I didn't do it on his birthday. So there are these three pieces. There's shame, there's guilt, and there's forgiveness. Now, the interesting thing is when you forgive someone or if you forgive yourself, you let go of the shame, which allows you to concentrate more on the guilt. You can actually make up for the mistake that you've made. When you don't forgive yourself, what happens is you don't want to look at the guilt because the guilt makes you feel the shame.
Mm.
And so if, let's say I hadn't forgiven my father, right? And that shame, you know, I thought about, oh, the fact I didn't call him, oh, I'm a failure, right? Immediately what I'll start to do is I'll start to want to avoid that. And I'll go, oh, no. Well, you know, he did this to me, X, Y, and Z. And I'll start coming up with excuses for the fact that I missed his birthday in order to avoid my shame. Because when guilt leads to shame, then we avoid facing the consequences of our mistakes. We avoid the fact that we've broken our own rules. But when we let go of the shame, when we forgive ourselves, then we can look at the guilt directly and we become more likely to make up for any mistakes that we've made.
So then how does forgiveness actually fit into a spiritual path or into actual spirituality?
Absolutely. Forgiveness, you could say, forgiveness is at the heart of every spiritual tradition. It takes different forms in each spiritual tradition, but it's at the heart of it. Because we're brought up in a Judeo-Christian culture, I'm going to use the Christian understanding of forgiveness as an example of how that works. In the Christian tradition, you know, we're born with original sin, right? We have sinned. We make mistakes. And what that means is that we're somehow separate from divinity when we sin. We've lost touch with the flow of the universe, with the Tao, with the everything that gives meaning to life. We've lost touch with God. And so we feel separate from God. We're kicked out of the divine kingdom. We don't have heaven. Okay. Jesus, in the Christian tradition, comes along and says, I will take on your shame. I will vouch for your character and say, you are saved. If you believe in me, I will forgive you for all of your sins. I will release you from all of your shame. And in releasing you from the shame, you can then be one with God. You can then go to heaven. So in the sense of forgiveness, forgiveness allows us to let go of our shame so we can take on the guilt. In a Buddhist tradition, we could say the process of forgiveness is to recognize that everything that you've done is just stuff that you've done. That who you are is the Buddha. You already are that, and nothing you can ever do will have you become the Buddha. You already are that. You know, like they say, trying to become enlightened is like trying to have a left foot. You know, you can try and try and try, but you've already got it.
Mm-hmm.
And the process of trying to get it is just an illusion. We think that we're somehow imperfect. We think that there's something wrong with our being. We have shame. And what the Buddha taught was all of that shame is just an illusion. And the process of becoming enlightened is the process of forgiving yourself, letting go of all of that shame. And then once you do that, then there's the Eightfold Path, which is a set of moral principles by which you can take on your guilt and act appropriately according to the values of your heart.
So I'd like to get into that for just a minute, because there's this there's something I have seen and heard about, mm-hmm. where, you know, they take half of that. Well, trying to be enlightened is like trying to get a left foot. Mm-hmm. And they go, well, I don't need to walk a path. I don't need to build any muscles. Mm-hmm. I don't need to have a daily spiritual practice. I need to just realize that I am infinite awareness right now, the pure witness. Mm-hmm. And if I just do that, and spiritual teachers will say, now, if you just go do that. Mm-hmm. And what I just heard you say is it's both.
Yeah. I'll expand on that in the Christian tradition. There's a great bumper sticker. You might have seen it. It says, Christians aren't perfect, just forgiven. Right? And there's two ways of looking at that. When you confuse shame and guilt, when you collapse the two of them, you say that when I forgive shame, I'm forgiving guilt. So let's say I've stolen something, and you say, I forgive myself for stealing. Well, if you've confused shame and guilt, what you're saying is, I wasn't a bad person for stealing. Stealing is okay, right? Which, you know, is completely not the case. But when we understand shame is different than guilt, and we understand that forgiveness is letting go of shame rather than guilt, then what we say is, I stole. When I forgive myself or when I forgive another, what I do is I say that their being is not evil. Their being is good. Their behavior is absolutely unacceptable. It destroys the moral fabric of society, mm-hmm. and it creates an ugly world.
Or in the modern vernacular, sucks.
Yes, it
sucks.
Their
behavior sucks.
Exactly. Murder, thievery, Yes. Rape, violence, these things are horrid things. The person who did them is not an evil person. Mm-hmm. Their action was evil. And this is differentiating the being and shame from guilt. Now, as it relates to the spiritual traditions, people might say, as a Christian, I'm forgiven. Or as a Buddhist or New Age person say, well, all I have to do is recognize that I'm enlightened, and then there's nothing else to do. And it's half true, as you said. When you recognize that you're enlightened or you recognize that you're forgiven, what you do is you say, my being is good. My being is a part of the divine spark. I am an aspect of divinity. I'm connected to divinity. I'm part of the universal creative force that created and sustains the universe. My being is good. I'm forgiven. That part of me is enlightened. Once you've done that, then you've got the other question, which is, what about my guilt? What about the practices? What about my actions? How do I act in such a way that creates beauty, that doesn't create pain and suffering, but that creates beauty? And that's why, even though Christians are forgiven, they have a strict moral code that they have to follow even when they're forgiven. Because forgiving is about your being. It's not about your actions. Same way with the Buddhists. You're already enlightened. All you have to do is realize that you're already the Buddha. That's about shame and your being. And then on the other hand, you've got the Eightfold Path, which is all about actions, right livelihood, acting with honesty and integrity. And it's when people collapse shame and guilt, then the idea of forgiveness really trips them up. You're like, I can't forgive a rapist. I can't forgive a thief. I can't forgive a murderer because that would somehow sanction their act. And we can't do that. We all know that forgiveness is the path. You know, when you forgive, it sets you free. Mm-hmm. And it truly does. But when we confuse guilt and shame, then we don't feel comfortable forgiving because it's as if we're saying, this rule, this law, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not rape, these things are somehow okay.
So when you unfuse those two, differentiate them, Then it's not that you can't forgive. It's almost that you must for your own spiritual health. Is that?
Well, when you say you must, if you want spiritual peace,
right?
If you want to feel a sense of connection with all of existence, if you want to have true happiness in your life, the more you forgive, the more you'll have that.
Yes.
The more you forgive yourself, first and foremost, and say, who I am is connected to divinity. There's nothing that's different. If you're a Christian, you say, Jesus has saved me. If you're a Buddhist or New Age, you say, I am already the Buddha. My being is good. And because of that, I can now look full force at my behaviors and say, whoa, that isn't working. That sucks, to put it, you know,
right.
as you
in the
it.
Modern vernacular.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. And that's why there's a whole section in this book on integrity. Integrity, yeah.
No. I'm sorry. You had mentioned before about how there's, you know, in this book you're getting to so many of these core principles like integrity that are common regardless of one's divine connection or not, or one's particular religion. That, you know, spanning the globe of all different religions and all different aggregated belief systems that humans have, you know, taken upon themselves, there are some core consistent things within them that I'd like you to talk a little bit more about. And then tying that into this notion of ourselves and how those serve us in I want to say protecting our self-esteem is just the word I'm picking and mm-hmm. choosing here around this separating shame from guilt thing, where I can less have so much of the actions that I engaging in my world affect my core being at the shame level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I think you talk about self-esteem, and I think self-esteem is the essential issue. The self-esteem can be thought of in two ways. One, it can be thought of in terms of, shall we say, guilt in our actions. We can look at self-esteem in actions and say, I have a certain amount of skill. I can take care of myself. I can communicate. I can build relationships. I can build a career. And I have confidence about that. I feel good about my ability to do that. Then there's self-esteem in terms of my being, which is I'm a good person because I have a good career. I'm a good person because I give to charity. And that self-esteem is about our being. And when you ask about, so how does this relate down to myself? How does this relate to my true values? You know, what are the values that are really going to make me happy? And in the book, I talk about street lamp and key values. A street lamp value is anything that you do in order to feel good about your being. It's anything you do to avoid shame. Okay. Whereas a key value is anything you do because it's a spontaneous expression of your heart, because it creates beauty, because it makes you feel good. Now, unfortunately, the difference between the two of them is not in the physical world. It's in how we approach them. So, for example, I can want a nice house, and I can want that in order to feel good about myself, or I can want that in order to create a context in which to raise a healthy family.
Right.
Okay. Now, when I want it in order to feel good about myself, in order to prove that I'm worthy, it's a shame project. It's a shame-based project, and it's about trying to enhance my self-image, how I feel about myself. When it's a key value, it's about how does this help me create more beauty in my life? Well, by having the house, it gives me a safe place to raise my children. It gives me comfortable furniture to live on. It gives me beauty. It gives me a place where my friends can congregate. These are all natural values, and I always talk about natural values and street lamp values. A natural value is a key value. They're values that are true for all people across all times and in all cultures.
So it seems to me that those two, one is deeply personal, and the other one is just practical. Like, it's a good choice. Does that...
Yes. In the book, I talk about personal and practical values, or street lamp values are personal values.
Yes.
And by that, I mean they're about my person. Their value is what they say about me. Do they make me look good or do they not? Versus the practical values, which is, does it bring me happiness? Does it bring me pleasure? Does it bring me love and joy and creativity?
And if we could get back for a minute, because it's something that really fascinates, this idea of identification or disidentification, given that rumor has it, it's the ultimate spiritual practice. It sounds like the shame project is kind of evidence of identification, and a practical project or a key value or natural value would be evidence of disidentification, whether it's conscious or not. Is that accurate? Or
yes, that's right on. In the book, I go through an exercise in which I guide people to look at the various parts of their life to discover who they truly are. And in the process, they discover that who they are is not their career. It's not their relationships. It's not their money. It's not their body. It's not their beliefs. It's their soul. It's their spiritual essence. That's who they are. However, if I think that I'm my career, if I think that who I am is my career, then when I go out to work in my career, I'm going to say, I'm successful, I'm a good person. And it goes into shame and my self-image, right? Oh my gosh, I have to be good at my career, otherwise I'm a failure as a human being. And if I'm successful at my career, then I'll finally prove that I'm good enough. So you could say that I've identified who I am with my career. And once I do that, it becomes part of my shame project, because now I'm using it to prove my worth or non-worthiness. In Buddhist thought and in some New Age circles, they talk about attachment, right? And they say, you can want whatever you want, just don't be attached to it, right? Which for most people is a very strange concept. Okay, I want it, but I'm not attached to it. How can we make this sense? How can we make sense of that? Fortunately, when we understand the difference between shame and guilt, when we understand the difference between street lamp values about our person, about our value as a human being, and key values or natural values and our ability to create happiness, the idea of attachment begins to make perfect sense. If we think that something is about our value as a human being, our shame, then we will be emotionally attached to it. Because if we succeed at it, it means we're a good person. Mm-hmm. If we don't succeed at it, it means we're a bad person. So our very self is on the line,
right,
if we create it or don't create it.
So that kind of sets us up to be constantly in avoidance of feeling bad.
Yes. And so we keep looking for more and more projects to finally prove that we're good enough.
Right.
Well, on the other hand, imagine that you completely knew that your person was good, that there was no ifs, ands, or buts about it, that there was nothing to prove and no one to prove it to. If you knew that you were connected to the divine, that you were already part of the divine process, let's say that you absolutely knew that without question. Well, in that case, the shame project wouldn't come up. Mm-hmm. And then you'd say, okay, well, given that, what do I want to do with this life? Since I no longer have to prove I'm worthy, I no longer have to do a career to prove that I'm good enough, I no longer have to have a relationship to prove that I'm lovable, I no longer have to be sexy in order to prove that I'm a worthwhile human being. Well, then the question becomes, what do I want to do? What would I do for the simple joy of the experience? And at that point, well, there's a million things you could do. You could create an art project. I might be a painter and say, I'm going to paint this painting. Now, if I'm truly, you know, if I've truly allowed the shame to let go, if I've forgiven myself, if I've accepted my divine connection, then when I paint the painting, I paint it for the sheer joy of the experience. I want it to be beautiful, but I'm not attached to it. Because if it's beautiful, great. If it's not beautiful, great. I'm not worried about it. It's all plus from here. You know, you could say that the shame project is trying to get to zero.
Right.
Right? Whereas the project of creation of natural values, of key values, is all about creating more and more and more.
So the way you just laid that out, it sounds like there's this big epiphany. And then kind of you're free and you can create the life you want. And I know in the work that I do as an evolutionary guide with people, I warn them right up front that it's a lifetime endeavor. And so if you could speak to the building muscle aspect, and do you think a daily spiritual practice is important? Or
Absolutely. In the book, I talk about exactly how important that is. Because the interesting thing about shame is that it's built so deep into our culture, it's built so deep into our character, that it's kind of an ever-present thing. And what happens is we let go of it to different degrees in different contexts. And so I think you're absolutely right. It's not that one time I realize that I'm a good person and it's over. You know, they're like, again, because we live in a Christian world, a Christian culture, we could say that we're forgiven by God, and then it's all over. And unfortunately, it just doesn't happen that way. What happens is we're forgiven, and we accept that we're Buddha. We accept the Savior, Jesus Christ, as our Savior, and then we're freed from that. Or we understand that we're part of the evolutionary creativity that made the world. In that moment, we have a moment of insight. And to the degree that we can hold that, we literally are free. We're at zero and we can move forward. However, what happens is we forget that constantly. We constantly forget that we're saved. We constantly slip into an unconscious feeling of shame. And so the work on a spiritual level is all about continually representing that we are a good being. That in fact, we cannot be a bad being. Nothing we ever do can ever change the fact that we're good. Nothing we ever do can make us bad as a being. Who we are in our nature is part of the divine creativity that created and sustained the universe. That's who we are. You know, the Eastern traditions talk about Maya or illusion. It's an illusion that we need to prove our value. However, it's an illusion we are all deeply mired in. And so it requires, as you say, a muscle or constant practice on a daily basis in order to continually remind ourselves that we are saved.
What are some of those things? I mean, we do live in a world where we are constantly bombarded with messages of inadequacy.
Yeah, that's the media.
Constantly. I mean, it's the media.
It's advertising.
Our advertising. It's the relationships that we've built up. It's the competition that we're in with one another all the time.
Yeah.
So those of us who are, you know, seeking this path, that are working to create our own internal dialogue and practices to support our divine connection and our knowingness that we are saved, as we say, or okay, or accepted, or connected, or, you know, whatever that is. Unfortunately, we're up against this thick matrix of an environment around us, where this thick gravity that's, no, you're not. No, you're not. You think you are? No, you're not. You don't have this. You don't have that. You thought you were great, but you're not really yet. Mm-hmm. And
if you only get this,
exactly,
then you'll finally be good enough.
And they're really good at sticking their messages right into our brain, or even more so now, right into our hearts, making us feel badly about ourselves.
And it works.
And it works very well. And unfortunately, it works to the advantage of some entities and organizations that are wanting us to feel that way, so they can sell us stuff to make us
at arm's length
feel better.
They spent $10 billion in advertising last year.
It's incredible.
$10 billion because it works.
So can you speak a little bit about, you were mentioning daily practices, and you mentioned here in the book about accepting our participation in divinity. I'm curious about that.
Yes.
So how do we combat some of this?
Absolutely. Well, you got directly to the heart of it when you say accepting our participation in divinity. Because when you ask the question, am I good enough, right, this shame-based question that we kind of all run around with the answer no, you know, and as you were saying, the advertising and different traditions and institutions teach us, no, you're not good enough. You have to do this, then you might be good enough, right? But you're asking the question, am I good enough? And that question, am I good enough, how could you possibly answer that? By what standard could you possibly answer the question about whether your very being is good enough? And when you really get down to it, there's only one entity or one authority that can tell you that, and that's divinity, or God, or the Buddha, or the higher self, or the creative urge at the heart of the universe. And I refer to all of that by the name divinity, because the divine is the highest possible good. And if we're going to determine our own worth, it is only the highest possible good that can determine it. And at the heart of every religious tradition, and even non-religious traditions, what we say is that the divine loves us. The divine has forgiven us. We are participants in that divinity. We're either participants because Jesus saved us. We're participants because it's our nature. We're participants because we participate in the Buddha nature. We already are part of that. And so it's recognizing that in any moment that gives us the freedom to let go of shame and begin to work on what would truly make us happy. Because where we say a street lamp value is asking the question, am I good enough? The key values are asking the question, am I happy? Does this make me happy? And the spiritual practice is about remembering, re-presencing, understanding, deepening the experience that we are good enough as beings. And so there's a whole wide variety of practices that can do that, right? In the Christian tradition, it tends to be prayer and contemplation, where you allow Jesus into your heart and allow Jesus to connect you to God. And when you're truly present and have that experience of being born again in Christ, you recognize that you're directly connected to divinity. And from that place, you can let go of your shame and begin to work on creating a truly beautiful life. In the Buddhist tradition, we might meditate. We could meditate on the Buddha of compassion, on the Buddha of love. We could do a Vipassana type of meditation where we just notice that the mind does its thing and the us, or the consciousness that's seeing it all, is divine. Any type of practice that gets us in touch with the fact that we are participants in divinity, that there's nothing we can do to get there, and there's nothing we could do that could ever take us out of it. We can never not be divine. It's the thought that we think that we're not part of divinity that causes us to feel shame. And when we feel shame, then we start trying to do all these things to prove our worth, which can never work. In the book, I say it's kind of like trying to dig a hole, right? And the digger you deep it, the more you try to fill it, the deeper you dig it. That's kind of fun to say.
Say it three times fast. Exactly.
And so spiritual practices are not about doing anything. They're about realizing that we already are participants in divinity. And again, it doesn't matter what the practice is, as long as it brings you to that point. Often we're brought up in a type of religious tradition. And so if we're on friendly terms with our tradition, then we can use whatever method it uses. So in a Christian tradition, you can pray. You can open your heart and ask God to come in, give you the strength, give you the courage, and open yourself to God's infinite love. You know, if you're a Buddhist, then you would meditate. You might meditate on openness, or you might meditate on a specific object. If you have some type of guru meditation, then you would focus on the object of love, the guru, and allow yourself to be enfolded and engulfed in its love, in its divinity. Whatever it is, you know, and if you're an atheist, because one of the things I say in this book is it's for people of all faiths and of no faith. Mm-hmm. As an atheist, because I've counseled atheists on spirituality, what I say is think about the creativity at the heart of the universe. Whatever it was that caused atoms to form into molecules, molecules into cells, cells into beings, beings into a being that could ask the question, how is it that atoms became molecules, right? Whatever it was that created that, whatever force that is, exists in every single cell of mm-hmm. our body. It exists in every atom. Our thoughts are manifestations of it. Our very experience of life is part of that incredible creativity at the heart of the universe. We're already participants in it. So you don't even need to have a religion in order to experience that. But whatever your path is, however you relate to the ultimate source of creativity in the universe, re-presencing that on a daily basis is the heart of a spiritual practice. And when we do that, when we recognize we're already participants, we've already won the game. Now the question is just enjoying it.
I love that notion of re-presencing that every day. It does seem to be increasingly imperative in this world.
And not only in every day.
We revisit that notion every day and in some way to reconnect.
Yes, and in every moment. Because the truth is right now, mm-hmm. right, listening to my voice or as I'm speaking, I can be completely clear. You know what? This whole thing is gorgeous. It's all God. You know, every part of life is God, and I'm a participant in it. And in that moment, I can feel open, I can feel peace, I can feel creative freedom. And then 2 minutes from now, someone can cut in front of me in traffic, right? And I forget all about God, right? And now I'm, you know, upset and I'm angry. And it's that simple. If I'm focused on how I'm a participant in divinity, then life becomes an unfolding of beauty, an unbelievable gift and opportunity. If I forget, then I can immediately go back into trying to prove that I'm worthwhile. In the book, I talk about a metaphor. I say that on the one hand, most people live their life as if they're on trial, as if they're in a courtroom, and the question is, am I good enough? Am I a worthwhile human being? And they're coming up with all the evidence they can to prove that they're good enough. Well, look, I've done this, and look, I've done this,
right.
And look, I'm better than this person. I might not be perfect, but I'm better than this person, and I'm better than that person, right? And so they live in this courtroom in which they're trying to prove their value, but which they never can. It's an impossible project because you can't prove it. But they think that they're locked in the courtroom, where the truth is, at any time, the door's open. All they have to do is turn around and leave the courtroom and go out into the wide world and make the life their art project. And the spiritual choice is whether or not we're going to get lost in the courtroom and try to prove our worth, or right. whether we're going to remember through a practice and go back out into the world and play.
That's a beautiful thought to end it on.
Mark, how can people reach you and where can they buy the book?
ThePriestAndThePunk.com. That's ThePriestAndThePunk, all one word, .com. It's got a great little cartoon about how the priest and I got together, traditional religion and modern culture got together and created something where we agreed rather than disagreed. And that's the best way to contact me.
Mark, thank you for being with us. Thank you for taking the time again. My name is Jason McLean. I'm an evolutionary guide in San Francisco. You can reach me through emotionalawareness.com.
And I'm Martin Matthews. I'm a certified medical hypnotherapist, personal coach, healthful living advocate, and co-host of Reality Sandwich every Thursday at noon here at 89.5 KPOO. We've been speaking today with Mark Michael Lewis and his new book, The Key is in the Darkness, Unlocking the Door to a Spiritual Life. Thank you again, Mark.
Can I, my toll-free number is 1-888-9-HAPPINESS. So it's 1-888-9-HAPPINESS if you'd prefer to use phone rather than internet.
Beautiful. We'll be back next Thursday. Thanks for tuning in.